This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, there are some new findings about the Tyrannosaurus rex and its ability to move from the Rex Lab on the UW La Crosse campus. We might all know the T-Rex as a big predator to watch out for back in dinosaur days, but you might not know as much about how it moved that large body and tiny arms fast enough to catch prey. Eric Snively is a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, specializing in vertebrate functional anatomy and paleontology. He runs the Rex Lab. He co-authored a study on the T-Rex's ability to turn in order to keep up with prey. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, before we get into this new research, obviously a lot of people find dinosaurs fascinating, people of all ages. What led you into the study of dinosaurs?
Well, I was 4 years old getting my hair cut in a barbershop in Utah, and there was a footprint, a dinosaur footprint on the ground there, and I got interested enough that I never really grew out of it.
And you are studying how the anatomy of things like T-Rex what it might tell us about how they move, how they behave, and things like that. How do we take what we have of a T-Rex, say, and figure out what that means about how they moved around on the Earth?
Well, we have to start with the bones, obviously. So we have fossil bones and skeletons, and we can infer a lot about the soft tissue biology of dinosaurs based on looking at muscles and other organs in their living relatives, birds and crocodiles. So we take a bird, which is technically a modern dinosaur, look at its muscles, look at those of a croc, which is a relative, and we map muscles onto the form of these extinct dinosaurs. And we calculate properties of their bodies, so how hard it was for them to turn, how much muscle force they can exert, and so on.
Now, anybody who's ever thought about what they would do if they're confronted by a T-Rex, and I assume that's everybody, has probably thought what I have thought, like, no big deal. They're horrific and dangerous, but they're big and lumbering. They'll charge straight at me. I'll just run off 90 degrees. They won't be able to turn fast enough. I was wrong, it sounds like.
If you were going up against an adult T-Rex, then it would probably be a good idea to, move at 90 degrees and maybe try and get behind it. However, if it was a juvenile, you'd have a really hard time getting away from it. So the adults were adapted for going after large elephant-sized prey, and an elephant or a triceratops would have a harder time getting out of the way than a person would. But again, if you were being chased by a human or a horse-sized T-Rex, a little juvenile, you'd be in trouble.
Right. And so talk about what we know about how those younger T-Rexes then would be able to turn.
Well, all tyrannosaurs, including T-Rex, from juvenile to adult, had bodies that were actually pretty short from the tip of their nose to the ends of their tails. And objects that are short like that are actually easier to turn than super long objects. So a good analogy is if you have a bowling ball in front of you that weighs maybe 10 pounds, you can spin it pretty easily. But if you have a long barbell that's maybe 10 feet long, that will be a lot harder to turn. So by having a more compact body, it was easier for tyrannosaurs to turn, and they had bigger muscles, bigger leg muscles and tail muscles to help them turn than other carnivorous dinosaurs.
So it's kind of a ratio thing, it sounds like, this head-to-tail difference versus their, I guess, overall size and weight. It makes them, even though we think of them as really big, they're still pretty compact. Do I have that right?
Exactly, yeah. So a T-Rex that would weigh about, maybe 10 tons would be about 12 to 13 meters long. Other carnivorous dinosaurs, that mass would be a lot longer, and it would be a lot harder for them to turn. And also, it's a ratio of how difficult it is to turn versus how big your muscles are and how much torque those muscles can exert, how much twisting force. So if you have big muscles that can exert a lot of leverage and a lot of force, you can turn a relatively compact body more quickly than if you were longer and skinnier.
Now, what am I eating if I'm a juvenile T-Rex versus an adult T-Rex?
My colleague Joe Peterson at University of Wisconsin Oshkosh just discovered that a juvenile T-Rex was actually feasting on the tail of a duck-billed dinosaur that it had eaten. So we have tooth marks on bones of prey of tyrannosaurs. So we know that juvenile T-Rexes would have probably maybe eaten carcasses the adults have killed and probably gone after more agile prey. And we know that the adults went after large live prey because we see tooth marks in the bones of Triceratops and duck-billed dinosaurs that have healed. So a T-Rex tried to acquire that prey, but the prey got away in that case. So we know that adult T-Rexes at least were hunting large herbivorous dinosaurs.
Now, getting back to what we can infer from the structure, from the bones that we have, and I know we have some footprints and eggs and things like that, do we start to have an idea of what the ligaments and the muscles and the stuff that holds everything together and makes everything move? Are we getting a pretty good picture, we think, of what a T-Rex would have looked like just under the skin?
We have a really good picture. Because we can compare extinct dinosaurs with modern birds and crocodilians, we can infer that they had muscles that are present in their modern relatives. However, we can also look at the size of the muscle scars and the size of the muscle attachments on the bones of these extinct dinosaurs. Turns out that tyrannosaurs had really, really huge hips for really big muscle attachments. They had big crests at their knees for big calf muscles. And they had really deep, robust tails. So muscle from the tail ran to the back of the leg, pulled the leg back, and drove the T-Rex forwards. And in tyrannosaurs, these muscles are huge compared with their body size.
I understand now you want to flip the equation and look at some of the herbivores and see what we can learn from their structure about how they would have moved.
It's pretty great. Some of my students here at UWL have made some computer models of these herbivorous dinosaurs, and they've used some of my methods to calculate how easy or difficult it was for them to turn. And the next stage is to look at the muscles of these big herbivores, so things like duckbills like Edmontosaurus or Anatosaurus, and or Anatotitan, I should say, and then big horned dinosaurs like Triceratops.
As we wrap up, Eric, if I were to say to you, Eric, I can give you 30 seconds of video of an actual tyrannosaur moving about, maybe hunting, what would you hope to learn from that?
I'd actually like to learn how they were using their heads and necks. So I imagine they would get in close enough with their ability to turn. And I'd like to have some of my own work tested on how quickly they could turn their heads. Turns out if you were standing next to a T-Rex, you couldn't jump away quickly enough. It would be able to grab and bite you. But I'd like to know what it was doing to attack these larger dinosaurs and maybe how it was excising flesh from its prey.
Full disclosure, I don't have such a video. But thank you, Eric, for sharing this amazing research with us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Eric Snively is a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, specializing in vertebrate functional anatomy and paleontology. He runs the Rex Lab on campus. He joined us to talk about a study he co-authored about the T-Rex's ability to turn in order to keep up with prey. Little nightmare fuel for you there. Coming up, we'll talk with an Appleton filmmaker about his virtual reality project that tries to get viewers to experience the lives of an undocumented family living in the U.S. That's coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Some of the best movies make us feel immersed in the world of the characters on screen. That feeling might come from great writing, acting, or in the case of a new film from a Wisconsin director, virtual reality. His project aims to put viewers in the shoes of a couple living undocumented in the U.S. while raising their young daughter. It's been screened at a handful of events around the state, with more on the way. Jose Antonio Lozano is a filmmaker living in Appleton. He wrote, produced, and directed Los Sueños de Anita, or Anita's Dreams. Jose, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
Now, before we get to the story you tell in the film Los Sueños de Anita, can you tell us about how you're telling this story? A lot of us, myself included, have never watched a virtual reality movie.
Yes, so this is an immersive 360 video experience. So the viewers get placed where the 360 camera is. It's so you're one fixed point, but you can look all 360 degrees. So I think immersive storytelling is important. A lot of people say that it's kind of like an empathy machine. So what I do to produce the 360 video is first with the 360 camera, and I used the Samsung 360 camera, which has two lenses. on each side. So it's kind of it's a ball and has two lenses that record about 180, 190 degrees
wow.
on each side. So in post-production, I stitch it together. That's the term, stitching. So you take both. So when you upload the file, it comes out as two separate kind of fisheye lenses. So you stitch it together, and you create one kind of sphere around the character, the viewer, basically. Or, yeah.
And so if I'm watching this, I have a thing. I'm wearing a visor or what?
A headset. Yep.
A headset,
yep.
I'd call
so
it.
So they're
okay.
VR headsets.
Great. And so the other characters maybe are talking. I'm in a room, and I can turn around and look all over the room as the action is going on?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's a great way for the viewer to feel more immersed into the story because they themselves are doing the panning, per se, or just following a character themselves versus, like, traditional filmmaking. The shot is directed, so the camera would pan and follow the character. In VR, the viewers themselves get to make choices if they follow that character this corner and either like listen to them either talking on the phone, or they can look the other way. Maybe there's something else going on the other side.
So I might want to watch it two or three times to say, oh, what happened over there while I was looking over there?
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Okay. Now that's the how. Tell us about the what. What is the story of Anita's Dreams all about?
So Los Sueños de Anita places viewers into the life of two undocumented parents. And they are raising a young 7-year-old daughter. And it's ambiguous whether it was very young when she came to the country or she either was born here. But either way, it tells us the story of kind of living in the shadows, which is a phrase that the undocumented people use to describe how they kind of exist because of this kind of fear that all of a sudden they're going to get rounded up or something. So everyone's just living they're just trying to live a good life here.
And how does your own story, Jose, inform what you did in this virtual reality movie?
So this is very personal to me. My family immigrated to the U.S. in 2002 from Venezuela. And for a while, we came on visas, and after the politics in Venezuela just kind of took a dark turn while we were here, we as a family decided to stay. So for a few years, we were technically undocumented in this country, but now we have things such as DACA. I, myself, my younger brother have DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and that's because we were brought as kids to the U.S., So Barack Obama executively passed this order that says that the action that's being deferred is deportation. So this gives us the ability to have a Social Security number, have a driver's license, and go to school because we grew up here. Like our whole lives, I came to the U.S. when I was 6 years old. I built my whole life here, and my oldest brother was married and was able to get his documentation that way, and now my parents are fully legal as well with their green cards.
Now, we can't just go to a movie theater and watch this. How can people see your virtual reality film?
Yes, yeah, so how I set up these events is I have either two or three of my own headsets, and I kind of either create an event around it or just if I'm a part of a side exhibition so that people have time to either sign up for a certain time slot or they can just kind of like wander through if it's kind of like a multi-exhibition thing, and then they can just check it out. It runs about 9 minutes. So I would set you up with a headset, show you how to kind of press play on your own, and then you go through the experience. And I've had a lot of great reception from the communities that have showed it in. I've had about 5 showings now. The first premiere was at UW-Milwaukee, which is the film school that I graduated from. And then I've had 2 exhibitions at art shows in Milwaukee, and I had One showing at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in the Fox Valley, and one very recent one at a networking event for black and brown businesses.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Jose, what do you hope people take away from watching Los Sueños Dianita?
I think that people should take away that undocumented people are not the monsters that the media or the current administration plays them out to be. It's very important for citizens to take action towards the legalization of people who are undocumented residing within this country by calling their representatives and asking for comprehensive immigration reform. And ultimately, we are all just people, and we just want to live decent lives, and the U.S. is the land of opportunity.
Jose, thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
Jose Antonio Lozano is a filmmaker living in Appleton. He wrote, produced, and directed the virtual reality film Los Sueños de Anita, or Anita's Dreams. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Under a bill that's expected to be signed soon by Colorado's governor, all nine of the state's electoral votes would go to the winner of the national popular vote, no matter who actually wins Colorado. They'd be the 12th state to adopt such a measure, along with the District of Columbia. It's known as the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. It would take effect when its members add up to 270 electoral votes. Right now, they're at 181 if you count Colorado, with more states working on adopting the plan. A lot of you have weighed in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tyrone writes, "The entire state of California didn't vote for Clinton, so why should she be credited with winning the entire state? Likewise, the entirety of Wisconsin didn't vote for Trump, so why should he be credited with winning the entire state?" Tyrone says, "The Electoral College distorts the results and ignores the preferences of Americans to do so." And Camille writes, "The Electoral College is a brilliant way to run our elections. Popular vote means a few large cities run the country. The Electoral College allows the entire country a voice in the process." Seth Maskett is a political science professor at the University of Denver. He's a weekly columnist for the Pacific Standard and the founder of and contributor to Vox.com's Mischiefs of Faction blog. Seth, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the arguments for and against this idea of the national popular vote, how would it work as states have been passing this?
Well, the idea is that once there are enough states to form a majority in the Electoral College that have joined this compact, then theoretically it kicks in and becomes effective. And all those states have agreed that they will cast their Electoral College vote with the candidate who has won the popular vote nationwide. So regardless of how that individual state voted, they would simply send enough all their electors to the popular vote winner. And with a majority of the Electoral College then following suit, then in theory, the Electoral College no longer matters. It's just whoever wins the popular vote wins the presidency.
But this is a bit of a workaround, because even if you don't like the Electoral College, it's still going to be there, short of, I guess, a constitutional amendment, right?
That's correct. And, you know, getting together the support to actually amend the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College would be very challenging, probably prohibitively difficult. So this is basically a workaround. It's still consistent with the Constitution. It just sort of makes the Electoral College basically irrelevant rather than getting rid of it.
And a key step here is, as a state passes this, if a state passes this, they don't start doing it right away. They don't start doing it until enough states, as you were saying, there are enough states to win an election, because otherwise they'd potentially be throwing their state's votes the opposite way.
Correct. Yeah. The decision on this is that it doesn't become effective until there's enough states to form a majority of the Electoral College. Right now, there's only around 90, or there's still about 90 Electoral College votes worth to go. So quite a few states would still need to sign off on this.
All right. We've had this movement around for a while now, just over a dozen years, I think. What's the argument from supporters? Why do they say we need to get away from relying on the Electoral College, bring it to the popular vote through this method?
Well, as they point out, two of the last five presidential elections, we've seen the popular vote winner not win the presidency because of the Electoral College. And, you know, there may have been perfectly good reasoning for that in the 1780s. It made perfect sense as a political compromise at that time. But we've come to expect, much more democratic behavior in the American government. And the whole idea that the American electorate is competent to do all these sorts of things, but somehow isn't competent to actually pick its own president, that should be left up to an electoral college. It just seems sort of inconsistent with the ideas of a modern democracy. And that also having essentially the less popular candidate take the presidency, which again has happened a few times recently, potentially causes a legitimacy crisis. If this continues to happen and you have most people picking one person and the presidency going to another, people start to kind of lose faith in a democratic system at that point. And it's potentially a dangerous area for a democracy to find itself.
Now, Seth, you've had front row seats to this debate there in Colorado. Did this feel like an angry, heated kind of debate, or was this kind of a back burner issue that just kind of made its way through?
No, it got some attention. I mean, you know, Colorado legislators, even when they're pretty polarized, tend to be kind of polite about these things. But there was it was pretty strongly partisan one, a partisan bill that was working its way through, and you know, mainly Democrats who were backing it, and mainly Republicans who were opposing it, and offering both moral and kind of constitutional reasoning on both sides.
This, as you mentioned, it's happened a couple times that the popular vote winner lost in the Electoral College. Both times that happened in recent elections, it was the Democrat winning the popular vote and then not proceeding to become president. Is that part of why this is becoming or being seen at least as a partisan issue?
Definitely. So it wouldn't be that hard to imagine, say, in 2004. That was a fairly close presidential election. All what had to happen, maybe, 30 or 40,000 votes shifting in Ohio, and John Kerry could have won the presidency but lost the popular vote, defeating George W. Bush. Had that happened, basically, you have two successive elections where each party was, essentially robbed of the presidency by the Electoral College, I think we would have seen pretty quickly a bipartisan national movement to get rid of the Electoral College. But right now, it seems to systematically disadvantage the Democrats, who can kind of run up their popular vote numbers in some of the more populous states, but not get any Electoral College credit for it. And so it's become a pretty partisan issue as a result.
Before we get into the arguments against this idea of a national popular vote, one weird possible wrinkle: if a state votes to support this idea and then other states do it and it kicks in, state governments change and a future legislature could vote to get rid of it. Is there a provision for opting back out if one state brings this back under 270 electoral votes? I know I'm bringing up a real hypothetical there.
I think that is a legitimate hypothetical, and I honestly don't know the answer to that. I think that should the state government change hands, which happens with some frequency, I think there might be attempts to get out of the compact, and it's not clear what the provision is for doing that. I'm also sort of curious, honestly, the enforcement of this, I find a little, I just have a lot of questions about it. For example, imagine, so Colorado's democratically controlled state legislature has just approved this bill. Let's say Donald Trump somehow wins the popular vote nationwide in 2020, but loses the vote in Colorado. In theory, Colorado's legislators, would then be pledged to vote for Donald Trump, even though, this is a democratically controlled legislature and their own constituents have voted against Donald Trump. This puts them in a real bind. This is an unenviable political situation to find themselves in, and I'm sort of curious what actually happens in that situation.
We're talking about the idea of a national popular vote. It has passed in a handful of states now, Colorado, the most recent New Mexico, working on it. The idea that a state will award its electoral college votes to whichever presidential candidate gets the most popular votes nationwide. Seth, let's get into some of the objections to this idea. What are some of the biggest arguments you're hearing for going with the electoral college as it is?
They're just sort of the... the kind of classic arguments for having an electoral college in the first place, which is that, you know, the nation was founded not necessarily as a simple popular democracy, but as a collection of states, and that those state identities are important. And so, you know, even if some states like California, New York, or Texas are, you know, have a lot of people in them, that doesn't mean that they should get to decide who the president is on behalf of everyone else. And so essentially, you know, the Electoral College provides some extra representation for smaller, more rural states, you know, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Nevada, and other relatively small states. Get a little bit of an extra representational advantage. And it simply means that, you know, a presidential candidate can't really run up the vote in just one part of the country. They're kind of committed to a campaign across a lot of different areas.
Right. That's an objection we've heard, in fact, from our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page, the idea that, hey, if you're going for popular votes, why would you campaign anywhere but where there's a lot of people? Am I going to go to, you know, New York or Los Angeles or, I don't know, Wyoming or Hawaii? It's going to, those smaller states are really going to see nothing when it comes to presidential campaigns.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's certainly a concern. You know, on the other hand, we see, you know, the most populous states right now, and again, I'm talking California, New York, Texas, are basically ignored in general presidential elections right now, simply because they're not assumed to be competitive. So a lot of the campaigning occurs where not that many people live.
Looking at the future of this idea of a national popular vote, Republicans control more state legislatures around the country, often in these smaller states that worry about being ignored. Is that an insurmountable roadblock for this idea?
Not necessarily. The simply because some of the larger states contain so many electoral college votes. So that, you know, it is, and, you know, just the fact that Democrats have won electoral college majorities in the not too distant past suggests that, you know, the votes are potentially there for this sort of a compact to pass. But, you know, whether they'll actually get that together and how many years it would take to do that remains a little bit uncertain.
Bigger picture, under the Constitution, states have maybe more latitude in how they arrange their electors and electoral votes and elections in general than we might assume. Can you talk about how much wiggle room individual states have?
Well, the Constitution really affords states the ability to decide how they want to allocate their electors. I mean, there's a lot of norms that have developed over the years. 48 of the states do it on a winner-take-all system. Whoever gets the most, whichever presidential candidate gets the most votes in that state gets all of the electoral college votes. States don't have to do it that way, but simply, you know, most have chosen to do that. And honestly, there's no real rule saying that it has to be done by a vote. In theory, the state legislature can simply decide who the electors are, regardless of how their citizens vote. This would be considered a huge affront, but there's nothing in the Constitution preventing that today.
Was there a bigger variety of methods early on before those norms developed?
Yes, earlier some states did it by popular vote. Some states did it through the legislature. In Colorado, I believe, the very first time it cast its votes in a presidential election was just a few months after its statehood in 1876. The state legislature decided at the time there wasn't enough time to organize an actual election. So the legislature simply sent all three of its electoral college votes for the Republican in that, which ended up being a fairly hotly contested presidential election.
And finally, Seth, do you see momentum out there for national popular vote as Colorado is in, other states thinking about the idea?
There certainly seems to be more attention paid to it. And I think people are more thinking about this as the 2020 election approaches. Now, there's very little chance that this compact would affect 2020. But as people look around at the polls, you know, particularly Democrats are looking at you know, what the electoral map looks like for 2020 and saying, here's yet another election where the Republican could lose the popular vote and still retain the presidency. So I think they're sort of thinking about some longer term solutions, and this is probably the number one on their list right now.
Seth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Seth Maskett is a political science professor at the University of Denver. We talked to him about the growing number of states joining the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Colorado is about to become the 12th, bringing the total number of electoral votes to 181. It needs 89 more electoral votes to take effect. How do you think the president should be elected? Should we keep the Electoral College in place or go by whoever gets the most popular votes? You can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page.